So we're studying 1 Peter chapter 3 this morning. This is my first time really doing an in-depth study in Peter. It's been very interesting, very enlightening. I think a lot of us have gone through the experience of when you study Acts and you see when the letters were written, how putting them in their historical context just like brings a lot of light to them. And I feel that after studying this, I feel very much the same way as far as Peter's life. We're very fortunate. A lot of the biblical writers we don't always know that much about, or we're not even confident who wrote it. In this case, we know that it's Peter, and we have a lot of detail on Peter's life in the Gospels. And so I guess my admonition before and after this class is, if you take the time to look at Peter's personality and the events in his life, and then you come back and look at this letter, it's just amazing what he's put in there. And, you know, based on when this was written, I assume he was roughly my age when he was following Jesus and then betraying him and then Jesus resurrected. And I assume he was roughly 55 or 60 years old by the time he's writing this letter. I don't know those exactly, but the feeling I get as I read this and as God's inspiring him to write this is that he has, his personality is a rocky one. Like it's, and I mean that because of his name, but also like it's a bumpy personality. He had a lot of bumps in the road. And certain things that he really keys in on in this letter, it's like he spent another 30 years digesting and working on his problems, and now he's trying to teach us how to work through those same things. So I think that's what we're going to see as we go through 1 Peter chapter 3. We're in the middle of the letter, so I'm going to read the whole chapter, and then I'm going to spend 5 or 10 minutes kind of building out the context of where we're at within the book. And then we'll go in and dive in verse by verse. So I'll have it up here on the screen, or you can follow along, of course, in your own Bibles. I'll say also before I read, this starts with the term in the same way. It's referencing back to the middle of chapter 2 where Peter starts talking about being in submission under ruling authorities, if you're a slave under your master, and then he's continuing that thought here. He says in 1 Peter 3 verse 1, "In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives, as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. Your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair, wearing gold jewelry, putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, the former times, the holy women also who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. Just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life so that your prayers will not be hindered. To sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead, for you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. For the one who desires life, to love and see good days, must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. He must turn away from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation, do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. And keep a good conscience so that in the thing which you're slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. For it's better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. For Christ also died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust, so that he might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he also went and made proclamation to the spirits now in prison, who were once disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah, during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through the water. Corresponding to that, baptism now saves you, not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who is at the right hand of God, having gone into heaven after angels and authorities and powers had been subjected to him. So I want to just take a second to let that soak in, think about some of the things we read. It kind of, on first read, it almost feels like there's a lot of different kind of topics going on here. I think we'll see that it's actually kind of all one thought line, but we see some verses that I think are pretty memorable for us. So this statement about a woman being submissive and the value of a gentle and quiet spirit, that's one I think a lot of us are familiar with. And I just want to comment at the beginning here that it's very interesting that Peter is talking about that, because that's very much the inverse of his personality, a gentle and quiet spirit. So it would seem in his older days that he's seeing more and more value in that. We see other comments. There were some quotes. So I don't know if you noticed, there's a big section that's taken out of Psalm 34. There was another quote that came from Isaiah. And then there were some other terms, some other scriptures I think we're familiar with. There's chapter 3, verse 15 that talks about being ready to give an answer. Surely something we've discussed a lot. When you get towards verse 21, it starts talking about Noah and its impact on baptism. And then maybe we even notice some of the really weird comments about this was all done so Christ could speak to the spirits in prison. And we look at that and they're kind of like, what? Like, I don't know what's going on with that. There's a lot in here. I am not going to be able to pull everything out that we're covering. So I'm intentionally going to leave some stuff behind. So some of those hairy verses, like what does it mean for Christ to have preached to dead spirits in prison and everything, I'm simply not going to get into that, because to try to do that in our 30-minute class, I would miss so much other value that we also need to be getting. So with that in mind, I'm going to treat this as a bit more of a character study, and I'll get into what I mean by that in a second. The other thing that I think is helpful to be aware of, so like I said, we're in the middle of 1 Peter now. We're midway through the book, and I put together five lines or 5 points on the screen here. You are away from home, a stranger, but you were chosen or called. So develop your internal or your imperishable qualities, that which is inside of you, and let the world see a different kind of beauty to the obedience of Christ and the salvation of your souls. If I was to put the book of Peter, 1 Peter, into 5 points, this is what I would put it into. You might say, well, why or how did I come up with this or how did I develop this? I didn't really come up with this. All I did is, if you look, I put those 5 points at the top of the screen. I put the very beginning of the book at the bottom of the screen. Here's the first 2 verses. Peter laid it all out for us. I'm going to take and gray out the things that Peter essentially had to say. So he had to tell you his name, that he's an apostle of Christ. And he had to say the locations he was sending it to. And he probably had to include the greeting that was always included in a letter. May grace and peace be yours to the fullest. But if you look at everything he said that he didn't have to say, he laid out for us the structure of his book. To those who reside as aliens, scattered. These are people who have been dispersed. They're now living in a foreign land in a strange place and they're trying to get used to it. Who are chosen. These are people that God chose for a specific reason. And it says that was according to the foreknowledge of God the Father. And Oliver discussed how that really speaks to the spiritual qualities that God selects for, those imperishable qualities. And then it says, by the sanctifying work of the Spirit. Now, sanctifying leads us to holy. That came up a lot in Steve's discussion last week. The thing that I think is going to stick out to us as we look at the sanctifying nature is us being made holy means us being different. Different than those around us, and that comes with a certain set of characteristics and feelings and challenges that are going to come up continually through Peter. And then finally, all things point to Jesus, to the obedience of Jesus Christ, and to be sprinkled with his blood, to have his salvation. And the reason I bring this up now, even though we're not in chapter 1, is because as you look at those, sorry, the font got kind of overlapped here, but as you look at those 5 points, Peter basically rehashes all of these 5 points as he progresses through the book over and over again. So the notion of being a stranger or a sojourner, you'll see it happen at the beginning. You'll see it happen in the middle of chapter 1. You'll see it happen in the middle of chapter 2. It's a little bit more discreet, but it'll even come up in chapter 3. And you can do the same thing with being chosen or called. And you can do the same thing with imperishable qualities that are more pure than gold. And you could trace it through the book, and he keeps bringing them up. And what he's doing is he starts you off with the notion of being born again. What does it mean to be baptized and to start life fresh as a new person? Then he goes through and he says, as a newborn babe, long for the pure milk of the word, that you can grow. Then he starts talking about being up and growing into a spiritual building with Christ as the chief cornerstone. And in chapter 3, the stage that he's on to is what I would call being decorated. So think for a second if you look at the world of athletes, and you were to say that's a decorated athlete. We've got some athletes that are good, some that are really, really good, and they become professional. But you pick a couple of those special professionals and you say, that's a decorated athlete. Decorated meaning they've got the gold medals. Tons of them. Whether that's any of the Michael Jordan, Michael Phelps, Usain Bolt, anybody you want to pick that's the best at their sport ever, they could have a series of gold medals draped around them. So we call them a decorated athlete. You could think of that as a military person who's spent 20, 30, 40 years in the service, who's gone to war in a number of places, who's essentially a war hero. We would call them a decorated veteran or a decorated person in the military. And they've got medals and pins showing the history of what they've done. This could go on in many ways. The question that we have put before us in 1 Peter 3 is, what is a decorated Christian? You go through the stages of being born again and then maturing in Christ. And as God continues to develop you and you continue to grow in your faith, if God was to look at somebody and go, that's a decorated Christian, what are the traits that would characterize that person? That's what I think Peter is really trying to get at here. So as we develop that thought and what that looks like, Peter has given us five people to think about. And they all have similar characteristics. I don't think it's incidental when he mentions a person that he just happened to say, well, this person's a good example. Let me throw one sentence in about them. I think he's looking at the whole body of work of Scripture and looking at that entire story of that person's life and then digesting it and then putting it into this chapter because it serves a purpose that that person struggled in the way that we're about to learn that we will struggle. And so as you look at each of these people we're going to talk about, you can follow these 5 points that I've bulleted are the same exact 5 points out of the beginning of 1 Peter. I just put them in different words to match a person. So these people were chosen by God, typically for qualities that those around wouldn't notice or couldn't see. They were called out from their original home or their original circumstances to go and follow God. Because of those things combined, they often stuck out as weird, odd, not typical. But they continued to cultivate their dedication to God and the spiritual parts of them. And God continued to develop and purify their imperishable qualities through fiery trial. And as we look at the people Peter is bringing up, we're going to see that, again, I don't think it's just anecdotal that they come up in this chapter. So if you think about who those people are, Jesus. That one's kind of obvious. He comes up throughout the whole book. Peter is going to be one of those people because he wrote it. And then there's 3 people that are mentioned. One of them, their name didn't come up. Sarah is mentioned. Noah is mentioned. And we didn't see David's name, but he quoted at length from Psalm 34. And when we go more in depth, we'll see, I think, why that's a very pointed scripture for him to have pulled. And the other thing we're going to see as we go through this is that outside of Jesus, all of them sinned in a very similar way, which is what I think really brings to focus the learning that Peter wants to bring in chapter 3. So once again, as we go through the chapter, there's a lot of things I'm intentionally going to miss for the sake of time, but what we are going to do is kind of camp out on the people that we're looking at. So as we look at the first section here, verses 1 through 7, once again, as I mentioned, it starts within the same way, and this is referencing back to the middle of chapter 3. Peter has been working on how do you behave in essentially foreign situations where you are under the rule or guidance of somebody else, and there's a difference between the way they would guide and the way that you would do it. What do you do? That could be a king, that could be a master, and now he turns to say, what if that's your own husband? What if you are a wife and the person who is leading you is not a faithful person? And so his admonition here is, wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word. First thing I think that's important to keep in mind is the definition that Steve gave us last week of submissive. Today, submission might mean something in Ultimate Fighting where somebody chokes you and you tap out. You are subbed or submitted by force. That is not what this word is intended to mean. This is where you choose to allow yourself to be in lower rank in a way in order to help the broader group or team or function, to allow somebody else to lead you. And there's an interesting phrasing here that it says, if some of them are disobedient to the word, that they may be one without a word. So part of this, I think, leads to the quiet spirit that Peter's going to talk about in a second. But I also want to be careful, just as other scriptures that talk about women being silent or quiet, that we don't overinterpret that word to mean something it doesn't mean. I don't think this is intentionally saying she can't be a talker if she's going to have this impact. Women who use a lot of words can still have the impact that Peter is getting after here. Now, there is something special about a quiet person, which he's going to address. But I think the tone of this is they are disobedient to the word, yet they're going to be one without a word. Word can mean a literal word. Word can mean an idea. It's also, if you look at the Hebrew history that this is all coming out of, the Ten Commandments were actually called the Ten Words. So this is almost like saying he can be won over without the wife having to command him what to do. She doesn't have to boss him around to change him. There's a different path. Then it kind of hones in on this in more depth. So it says that they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. Your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair, wearing gold jewelry, or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. So here he focuses in on what does it look like for that woman who is going to win over her husband or make a true spiritual impact without essentially having to boss him or then lead him around. And what he hones in on is the decoration. This is what I mean by a decorated individual. Somebody who is a decorated person in normal life is very noticeable. They stick out to something visual. If somebody comes wearing a lot of gold or really, really fancy clothes, that sticks out to the typical person. And what Peter is honing in on is somebody who sticks out to somebody with spiritual eyes. So I think of this as the way when God was choosing David. And so Samuel and Jesse get together all the sons, and they're looking for the biggest, tallest, oldest, strongest son. And what we are told is, God sees, not as man sees. And so in the same way, what God is calling for, what he is choosing us for, is qualities that most people will not notice. They're qualities that are inside of us that we continue to develop. And it might be that 99% of the world goes by and doesn't even catch it. But somebody with spiritual eyes, somebody with spiritual longing will notice a gentle and quiet woman who's decorated on the inside. And that's what I think Peter is trying to get down to with this. Then it goes on to use Sarah as an example. And in general, holy women from long ago. So he says, for in this way, former times, the holy women also who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. So, I find it interesting that he chose Sarah. If I was to think of a woman in the Old Testament who exemplified a gentle and quiet spirit and being submissive, Sarah's not the first one who would come to mind. Maybe Hannah, maybe Ruth, but something that sticks out to me about Sarah is as you read the narrative in Genesis with Abraham and Sarah and their wandering, there's some pretty significant portions of time where she's not calling him Lord and living a submissive lifestyle. So Abraham and Sarah go down to Egypt, And then there was one other place, the location name I'm forgetting, with Abimelech. And Abraham says, you know, pretend you're my sister because you're my half-sister. And there's all this stuff that goes on. And in those moments, it would seem that she listened. But then later on, after Hagar is with them, she, in a moment of struggle, tells Abraham, take Hagar and go have relations with her so that you can have a kid. That's crazy. Think about this in your own families. What woman in here would tell her husband to go with a presumably younger woman to have relations with her? Like, tell him to do it. That is crazy, but that is what she did. But this is what's interesting to me. That is a portion of an entire story. God came to Abraham after they had lived in Ur for presumably a very long time. They were very old, had a very established family and life. They didn't have any kids yet, but it would seem that that was where they lived. And God came and said to them, get up and go to a place that I'm going to show you. So Abraham presumably must have gone to Sarah and said, Sarah, we got to move. And Sarah says, where? And he says, I don't know, except that God's going to show us. Do we see an example of her fighting Abraham over it? To me, this is a lot like Isaac. When Abraham goes to sacrifice Isaac, you don't see Isaac fighting. And that's one of the most impressive things about him, is that he didn't fight against that moment. So Sarah followed Abraham's leadership for years and years and years without a foot of land and without a kid to show for it, trusting in what God had put on them. And that's what I think is so amazing is, yes, she made a mistake just like we all do. Yes, you could look back at that and go, I was insane. What was I thinking? But if you look at the entire span of life that the Bible covers for Abraham and Sarah, that is just amazing. To give up being able to make your house a home because you're constantly wandering for that long of a time is just an amazing feat. And then he's going to go on and carry the same principles to husbands, to live with wives in an understanding way. Once again, I cannot do justice to the term as with somebody weaker or explain all of these things, partly because I can't do it and partly because of the amount of time we have. So I am going to breeze by that and move to the next section. So in the next section, verses 8 through 12, is where Peter brings in Psalm 34. So there's this big quote here that starts with, the one who desires life to love and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. This is really interesting. Psalm 34 is a psalm of David. I'm just zooming out on it here. Don't worry about reading this. This might be small text. But I've bolded the section that he's pulling out of there. So you can see he takes a pretty solid chunk of the psalm. Number one, if you take some time outside of this class to digest Psalm 34, you'll find that a lot of the same terms keep coming up. So in this psalm, David is wrestling with fear and what you fear versus doing good. Fear, good, fear, good, fear, good. It comes up over and over throughout the psalm. And if you go back and read 1 Peter with that lens, you'll notice that he's popping up some of the same things. For instance, if I go backwards here to when we were talking about Sarah, and right here in the bolded section, I didn't call this out, but it says, and you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. And we almost don't notice it. We read past it. But if you go through it and read it again and again, you'll start to notice that Peter is building to a larger point here. So back in Psalm 34, we have this discussion of challenges of fearing others versus fearing God and what it means to do good. But the most interesting thing to me is that this is one of those psalms that not only tells us who wrote it, but it tells us when they wrote it, what situation they were in, and this is very pointed. So for a second, I want you to think. When we think about David and the issues he had, there is one example we almost always go to. David and Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite. That is the prototypical example of David's sin that comes up in our minds most often. Peter has intentionally selected, and God has intentionally selected, a psalm about David's shortcomings that has nothing to do with that. And if you go back and research this time in David's life, which happens to be exactly what we're covering on Wednesday night, last night, and next Wednesday night, which is really cool, David is a fugitive. He has been in the kingdom with Saul, protecting Saul, playing music for Saul, And he hits the point where he can't feel at home there anymore, so he's not showing up to dinner, and he's on the run, and Saul wants to kill him. And in that time period of being cast out from his normal living conditions, he starts to get stressed, and he starts to get fearful. And so you have this guy who is willing to go up against Goliath and beat him in battle. But then you see this scene where he goes and gets Goliath's sword, and then he goes before Achish, the king of Gath, and he pretends to be insane because he's afraid. And it's such an interesting challenge that you take this man who is so capable in this extreme circumstance to do extreme things for God. And then you put him in this quieter situation where he's outside of his comfort zone, and what happens? He flips. And so we're not going to go through this psalm, but I bring this up to say, if you take 1 Peter 3 and study it, and then take another period of time, study Psalm 34, go a level deeper, study David in that time, come back to 1 Peter 3, and things come to full color. In the section after that, verses 13 through 17, he says, "Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation, and do not be troubled. But sanctify Christ as Lord as your heart in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense." So, first thing, we see a quote from Isaiah 8. What is interesting to me is Isaiah 8 came up last week in 1 Peter 2, around verse 14 or 15, talking about the stumbling stone. If you go a few verses back, you see this statement that he's quoted. Do not fear their intimidation, do not be troubled. You go a few verses back, and it says it's written to the people throughout the remotest parts of the earth, to those who have been scattered. And so once again, I'm trying to hit on the characters. I'm not going to go deep into this text, but if you go back to Isaiah 8, you'll see once again, it's not an anecdotal comment where Peter's just trying to quote one brief line to make one single point. If you go look at the body of work in Isaiah 8, I think we'll find that there's a lot more to glean that's really coming into 1 Peter, as Peter is trying to teach people who are cast out from their normal living circumstances how to live. Then you get to verse 15, which says, "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you." This is where I think it's really interesting to consider Peter's personality. Peter was a lot like David. He was the first to stand up, the first to speak, the first to go, the first to fight. He was strong, he was willing, he was ready. At the end of Jesus' life, he's the one to say, "We'll go into battle. I'm ready to die for you." When they come to arrest Jesus, he's the one who draws his sword, cuts somebody's ear off. He's ready to go to battle. But think for a minute about one of Peter's greatest struggles and greatest failings. I'm not going to read the whole text, but I'll pull it up right here. One version is in Mark 14, 53 through 72. You can also see it in John 18, and I think you can see it in the other Gospels too. Jesus is going to the high priest. He's going into trial. It doesn't tell us this in Mark. It tells us it in John that he did not have access into that part of the temple or wherever they were meeting. The other disciple who was with him had access and tried to check him in. But then you see a verse or two later, Peter's back outside. So he's an outsider, literally and figuratively. He doesn't feel like he fits in there. So he's out warming his hands by the fire, and somebody comes to him and says, "Hey, you, aren't you a disciple?" Okay, this is a guy who's ready to draw a sword and go into battle and die. And somebody just said, "Hey, you, aren't you a disciple of Jesus?" And he freaks out. He says, "I neither know nor understand what you're talking about." And then the servant girl saw him again once more. "This is one of them." But he again denied it. And after a little while, the bystanders were saying to Peter, "Surely you're one of them. You're a Galilean. I can spot it. I can tell it. You're a Galilean. You're one of those guys with Jesus. You're one of the weird ones." But he began to curse and swear, "I do not know this man you are talking about." Just like David. And as I study Peter, I have to think this was one of the absolutely most impactful moments in his life. One of those things that he would chew on night after night after night and meditate on to say, how did I miss this one? And you read 1 Peter 3, and his answer is to take on the qualities of a gentle and quiet woman. Do you see that? His greatest failing was not being able to pull his short sword out of his sheath and go to battle. His greatest failing was not being able to leave it in and to simply answer with a quiet word, "Yes, I am a follower of Jesus." That was his greatest struggle. And we think of like the greats of the Bible and what does it mean to go out into all the world and preach the gospel. And we see these great sermons before large groups of people and we think, maybe I'm not as good of a Christian because I'm not traveling the whole world and doing all these crazy things and I'm not talking to thousands of people about Jesus. But what Peter's trying to bring us in is sometimes spreading the gospel isn't that way. Sometimes spreading the gospel is being ready to give an answer. Which means you're not going out just trying to say it everywhere you go, but every moment you are in, you are ready to give the answer. Never knowing when God's going to put that upon you. Never knowing when that person who's spiritual and looking for spiritual qualities is going to spot you because you're decorated on the inside. Those moments and being ready for those moments, Peter, I feel like he looks at his life and he says, I can go out and speak to thousands of people, but then look at me by the fire warming my hands and somebody asks me a simple question, I freaked out. And I betrayed my Savior. And so he gives us this recommendation to sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart. Set him there. Lock him in place there so that any situation you go into, you are ready. If you think of a decorated soldier, you do not send them to Afghanistan for a vacation. You're never just traveling in a dangerous foreign area for vacation. You're on a mission. A decorated athlete, you don't send them in the fourth quarter just to have a little bit of scrimmage. You send them in to take the game. And as a decorated Christian, what Peter's trying to get us to see is you're never just sitting by the fire. You're never going to get to be asleep on the job in these moments that we think of as simple. Because God could be bringing to us somebody who is looking for those spiritual qualities and going to ask us. And we need to be ready to give an answer for why that hope is inside us. Then we come to the final verses here, 18 through 22. Again, I'm not going to cover everything and all the depth that is in these verses, but what we see in the center of this is that he then focuses on Noah and baptism. And first of all, I will say that if you go back and read chapter 1, and go back and read this chapter, there's a lot of connections you'll start to build because he's talking about being born again all the way from the first chapter. And he's talking about imperishable qualities all the way from the first chapter. So if you go back and read these, there's a lot that really comes together. But notice, once again, he chose to bring up Noah. There's a lot of situations in the Bible you could choose to use to teach about baptism. He has chosen Noah. Noah worked for 100 years building the ark and probably looked like a complete weirdo. It had not rained and God's asking him to build an ark. He follows a God that so many people have rejected. He follows a way of living that so many people have rejected. And so there must have been people coming to him asking about him. He gives them an answer. They think he's crazy and walk away. But he did that for 100 years. And then the flood comes. Everything his faith was looking towards came true. The flood recedes. And now he's in a whole new world. It's basically recreated, and it's just him and his family. And let me ask you this. Have you ever gotten to the end of a work week, and at the end of the work week, you look back like, that was some hard work? And then you don't recognize it right away, but you kind of just check out. You feel like the work is done, and you just check out. You get lazy. You let your guard down. Or a big event that you've been planning, and it's finally over. Something stressful, you finally get through. It's over, and you check out. Okay, Noah gets drunk in this newly recreated earth. He plants a garden. The first thing we see is he gets drunk and it causes all sorts of family issues. He makes a huge critical mistake. But once again, look at the pattern that we see. He has spent a life in dedication of being odd and being weird and focusing on the spiritual qualities in a time where that made you feel like a complete foreigner and stranger. And after all that, he did make that mistake. Just like David when he was fleeing, just like Sarah after years of wandering with Abraham, just like Peter after years of following Jesus. These are the types of situations that God brings us to test us and to challenge us and to prove us through the fire, to make us better and better as we go. And I'll just say in closing, I didn't go in depth on Jesus because I feel like that's kind of what everything is pointing to anyways. But just to take a moment to consider Jesus in light of this topic, that Jesus carries all these same qualities. He had to leave his typical homeland to go to a new territory where he was weird because he prized his spiritual qualities instead of his physical qualities. And as he went through life, he was tested. And you can look at that same exact scene where Peter looks at his own betrayal of Jesus. And look at the traits of Jesus in that same exact scene. And go back and look at the book of 1 Peter as a whole. And what you see is Peter is digesting that moment in time. And he is looking at himself in this situation. And then he's looking at Jesus before the high priest. And he looks and he goes, he was silent as a sheep before its shears. He was like a gentle and quiet woman while he was being mocked. And here I was freaking out, acting crazy, cursing, swearing. And he looks back at Jesus and goes, that's how you do it. And if you look at that and reread this book, it just completely comes to life. That's all I have this morning. We'll go ahead and close there and start service in just a minute.